I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we will talk about what Hoosiers can expect from the session of the Indiana General Assembly that's going on now. We'll talk about what the big issues are likely to be, where the friction points may be found, and how the possibility of having Governor Mike Pence run for president might affect the proceedings. My guest will be Scott Elliott of Chalkbeat, Indiana, and my colleagues Leslie Weidenbender and Jacob Rund from thestatehousefile.com. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI, and Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about the session of the Indiana General Assembly that has just begun, what we can expect from it, and what some of the key friction points might be. My guests are Scott Elliott, who is the bureau chief of Chalkbeat, Indiana, Leslie Weidenbender, who's the executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and Jacob Rund, who is the assistant editor of thestatehousefile.com. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you for having us, John.
It's good to have you here. I probably ought to say, and it's presumably obvious, that Leslie and Jacob and I work together, obviously, at the State House File. Well, I want to talk, Leslie, I'll throw this to you first. I mean, give us an overview on the session, what it's supposed to do. What are the sort of the constitutional charges of what the legislators are supposed to do in this session? And maybe give us an idea of what some of the bigger issues might be.
This is the long session of the General Assembly, which, of course, happens every other year after the election. And the primary responsibility of the legislature in a long session is to pass a budget. And it's a two-year budget. It will be somewhere around $31 billion or so. And that will authorize spending for the next 2 years. So that goes through June 30th, 2017. The long session lasts from we started this week, and it will go through the end of April. If for some reason legislators wouldn't finish a budget by the end of April, the governor would have to call a special session to make that happen. There doesn't seem to be any reason they shouldn't be able to come to an agreement. The Republicans have a supermajority in both chambers. What that means is that Democrats have so few members that they can't even disrupt business by walking out. All the Democrats could leave the chambers and the Republicans would still be able to create a quorum to do business.
They pretty much have to ask permission to have caucus meetings.
Just about. It's just about that bad.
So, Scott, what do you think? The big issue, obviously, we've heard a lot of talk about redoing the funding formula for education here in this state. In fact, you and I talked about that just a few weeks ago in a program.
Yeah, it's now crystal clear that that's going to be the number one education issue in the State House this year. Spoke with Brian Bosma yesterday, House Speaker Brian Bosma yesterday about this, and he indicated that the goal is to try to raise funding for the lowest funded school districts, which happens to be the wealthier school districts. And the question is, will that also result in less funding for the highest funded districts, which are also the highest poverty districts?
Mm-hmm. Jacob, you just this morning, you were in the governor's budget overview preview session. I mean, what was he saying about education? What's in the budget there?
Well, it's really just a modest increase to education. It's nothing that we didn't really expect. Essentially, it gives more money to charter schools, which proved controversial with the Democrats, especially when those are performing below the expected levels. But it does increase the student funding per student. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it's a significant amount. And it does take away the cap on the amount of students that can, or the money that the students are allocated to go to a charter school.
We are talking about this session of the Indiana General Assembly here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Scott, we're hearing in the governor's budget, obviously, that there are modest increases, likely some friction points with the funding for charter schools. Anything else that stands out for you?
I think that the big news to me today was some specifics on what the governor wants to do with regard to choice schools. So we're talking both about charter schools and private schools that accept vouchers, state-funded vouchers. So on charter schools, the amount that he wants to raise, give an additional $1,500 above the state tuition level amount to every charter school in the state, regardless of performance, which was an interesting there were some questions from the panel, I gather. I was not there, but I gather there were some questions from the legislators about why not tie it to performance. He sounded open to discussing that. But the real bottom line of that is that adds up to about $41 million out of the $200 million proposed increase for education. So that's a pretty big bite. So it would be interesting to see how public schools react to that.
It's also really interesting. I mean, one of the things that they said was that they're trying to provide more equitable funding to charter schools. And I think that's because charter schools don't get the same property tax revenue that that public schools do, because they don't have public buildings, so to speak. They don't have the ability to go to property taxpayers. But what's interesting is that lots of charter schools actually have very high per pupil funding, because their funding is based in part on the district where they're located. So lots of charter schools are located in urban areas where there's already high funding. And so charter schools rank among the most highly funded in the state. So to give them a $1,500 per student boost, I mean, that's a significant boost. You know, the average per pupil funding in Indiana, Scott, you may know more specifically, but it's somewhere around $6,000.
Yes.
And it can get as high as about $9,000 and as low as about $4,500. But if you start adding $1,500 onto that, that is an enormous amount of money.
So you're talking, my math skills can be somewhat atrophied, but you're talking somewhere between a 33% increase in funding and a 17% increase.
There's no way from the general amount they're putting in education that regular public schools would get anywhere close to that. The governor proposed a 2% increase the first year and a 1% increase the second year. That's exactly what the General Assembly approved last year. Brian Bosma, the Speaker of the Indiana House, said today they're going to try to do more than that. And I'd be very surprised if that $1,500 charter boost actually made it into law.
Well, as Leslie knows better than anybody here, the first thing you hear from the governor is something of an opening offer, right? So I would not be surprised to see some negotiation take place in terms of that dollar amount. And also on this question of performance funding, it was interesting that he very quickly showed his cards today and said he was open to discuss that. Because the complaint from just before I came here, I was talking to a charter school advocate, and they were talking about this funding amount. And they were pointing to high-performing charter schools, like a Heron High School was the example that was used. Heron High School has been a school for quite a while, and everyone keeps saying, why doesn't it expand? Why don't they do a second school? Well, their answer is they're in a former school building, so they're in an old building, and it's expensive, and they don't have the money. So the person advocate was telling me, with this kind of boost, that school could replicate quickly. But, you know, do you also want the school that's been three years consecutive F to replicate? That's the question I think that'll be on the table.
Did the governor, Jacob, and I'm going to throw this one to you since you were there, did he advance any argument for not tying this to performance? Because that does seem to be a break with, you know, the whole accountability piece of the education reform movement that the governor has positioned himself as being part of.
Well, the governor wasn't actually there. It was the budget director,
Brian
Bailey.
In terms of did they make any kind of justification for saying we're not going to link this to performance at all?
No, that question was raised
by
Senator Karen Talion, but they pretty much just phased over it. They didn't really say anything. They said they were open to discussion, and they said that they understand that this is the beginning of a 3.5-month process, and that they assume that things will sort of come to light as the session comes to an end.
And advocates of charter schools in the past have argued that it doesn't always matter whether the school is fantastic or not, that most of it is giving kids a choice, and that the charter school doesn't always have to be rated higher than the public school or than the traditional public school in order to give kids a choice. So you're going to have some people who advocate for the school needing to be very high performing in order to get additional funding, but you'll have others who just say that the most important thing is providing parents a choice.
But I guess, Scott, where I'm going, at least with this, one of the arguments originally for both charters and choice was the market plays a role here. Mm-hmm. That if the school doesn't succeed, it goes under, it shuts down, and that way we enforce accountability. That argument in some ways seems to have shifted over time. I mean, you're hearing, for example, Bob Boehning in committee hearings saying that really a parent should be able to just make a decision about and be the ultimate, you know, person who is responsible for the child's education.
So I think there's actually there are two schools of thought on that in the community of folks who push for school choice. I think that there is a pure market argument, which is just what you said. If a school is bad, no one will go to it, and so it'll just go away or it'll fail, and the good ones will succeed and replicate. Okay, what's been interesting to me as someone who's covered school choice for more than a decade is really that argument has failed. Most of the advocates nationally for charter school choice or charter schools and choice will say you must have regulation on it because the marketplace in a school environment, for a variety of reasons, does not force the poor performers to close, and it does not always reward the high performers, Heron High School being an example. Mm-hmm. Why hasn't Heron replicated? They say they're ready to, they just don't have the money, right? Mm-hmm. According to the person I was talking to today. So those are two divergent points of view within that broader umbrella of folks who favor choice.
We are talking about the legislative session of the Indiana General Assembly that's going on right now. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, we've established, obviously, education is going to be a huge issue. What are some of the other big picture things that we're looking at, Jacob?
Some of the items, I think infrastructure is one. Mm-hmm. We heard today that the governor is requesting an additional $300 million for road funding. The 2020 road funding just had $400 million, the entire $400 million released. That release was approved today at the budget hearing. So I think it'll be interesting to hear the discussion during the session about the additional funding and how much money will be allocated toward that. Leslie, do you want to talk a little bit more about what else is going on?
Is there? Yeah, I mean,
yeah. I think ethics reform is going to be a huge thing as well. I think everybody probably remembers that we just had Representative Eric Turner, a Republican from Cicero, who resigned right after the election. He did that to go work with a mission group, but he had been under fire for advocating for some legislation that benefited his family in a behind closed door caucus. So he had been stripped of a leadership position and ended up resigning. He resigned right after he was elected, but announced it before the election. There was no way to get him off the ballot. So I see that the Republicans are going to be pushing for stronger ethics rules, and in addition, try to find ways that voters aren't stuck voting for people who they know are going to resign, because that happens more often than we would like. So that's going to be a huge issue.
And the process there is that the person who's representing is not the one selected by the voters, but by some precinct committee people in the district, right?
Sure. And in a district like Eric Turner's, which is predominantly Republican, it's almost impossible for a Democrat to come in. Even if they get to say that you don't know who you're going to be electing, it's still hard for a Democrat to get elected.
So we've got the ethics in terms of the election stuff. The other ethical issue that was popping, and some of it, obviously, Eric Turner was the most prominent example of that, but some of the stuff with Mike Delf played into it, too. His argument was obviously the debate over the constitutional amendment in regard to same-sex marriage should not have taken place within the caucus. It should have been out on the Senate floor to some degree. And Eric Turner was lobbying in caucus. So his argument was, I observed the letter of the law. you know, are we going to see regulation, do you think, or more ethics guidelines at the very least in terms of what goes on simply in caucus?
Well, I think part of the problem with the Eric Turner situation is that the forms that legislators have to fill out to disclose what their interests are somewhat limited. And so Eric Turner owned a company that owned a company that owned a company that benefited. And the payoff for him was pretty good, apparently. But he was able to disclose his ownership in companies that did not make it obvious of where his interests really were. And so I think that's what you're going to see change.
We are talking about the Indiana General Assembly here on No Limits. My guests are Scott Elliott, who's the Bureau Chief of Chalkbeat Indiana, and my colleagues Leslie Weidenbender and Jacob Rund, who are the Executive Editor and Assistant Editor of the StateHouseFile.com, respectively. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the Indiana General Assembly's outlook. My guests are Leslie Weidenbender and Jacob Rund of the StateHouseFile.com. They are respectively the executive editor and assistant editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and Scott Elliott, who is the bureau chief of Chalkbeat Indiana. Now, Scott, you've got an event coming up, right, we're going to be talking about some of this education funding and other issues confronting education.
This conversation is beautifully timed because Chalkbeat is partnering tonight with WFYI and the Central Library to host an event at the Central Library talking about the proposals that are expected on changing the funding formula. Our panelists are just fantastic. We have House Speaker Brian Bosma. We have Tim Brown, Chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. We have IPS Superintendent Lewis Farabee. And we also have a superintendent from suburban Fort Wayne named Chris Himsel, who's part of a group of superintendents that are pushing for change.
What are the, when you talk to people in education circles, what are their concerns? What's the level of anxiety about this upcoming debate over?
It's very high. I mean, the simple problem is this. Everybody has a complaint about school funding, and they're all right. I mean, the suburban districts are absolutely right. The southern are in a tough spot for various reasons. They, despite being fairly wealthy communities, they don't get the revenue from the state that they need, sometimes even provide basics. Like I have a friend whose kids go to Zionsville schools, and they don't have a full-time gym or music teacher, and their superintendent will tell you that's funding. So there's that problem. And then, of course, the urban problem or the high poverty problem, urban or rural, is just that there's extremely high costs to helping those kids succeed, kids who face poverty barriers in their lives. So how you balance those two, and if you're going to try to give more to one, do you have to take from the other? We just talked a little bit about the proposal from the governor to grow funding for education, but not by a huge amount. So you're not going to be able to count on just giving more, I don't think.
And I guess I should ask, too, in this whole thing, since we've had at different times the education leadership in the State Board of Education, Superintendent of Public Instruction, at, a near meltdown level. And maybe I could even take away the near and argue that it was at a meltdown level. How is all of this going to play in that ongoing, Donnybrook? I'm going to give all three of you a chance to weigh in.
Yeah, actually, they may know more than I do at the State House file. But I definitely think that that's going to be a big issue that will be talked about in the legislature, is whether there will be some kind of effort to fix from the legislative side what's been obviously a dysfunctional situation with friction between the governor's office, the State Board of Education, and the state superintendent, and the question of who gets to run education policy. I don't know if you guys are hearing anything different.
Well, I saw both Leslie and Jacob's eyebrows shoot up when I asked the question. Jacob's went up higher, so I'm going to let him answer first.
Well, it's important to know that the legislation that has been submitted as of now would not take Glenda Ritz out of office. Mm-hmm. Essentially, it would allow this to become an appointed position. I think it's 2020. And Glenda Ritz obviously would be out of office by then. So I think that's something that the Republicans were trying to sort of extend the olive branch and say, listen, it's not necessarily about you, but it's also we'd like to control who gets into that position as much as possible.
I think one of the interesting things here is it's something that you said, Scott. One of the things they have to determine is are people just fighting or is it actually dysfunctional? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've been used to for years now having superintendent Sue Ellen Reed was the superintendent of public instruction for a long time, who got along pretty well with everyone. She got along with Republicans. She got along with Democrats. There were disagreements, but nothing too outrageous. Then we had Tony Bennett, a Republican who was out there doing aggressive things, which frustrated both Republicans and Democrats. Mm-hmm. And then you have a Democrat in office. And the question to me is it actually dysfunctional or is there just a lot of real debate going on? Now, it does feel very dysfunctional when you're in the meetings sometimes. Mm-hmm. But in the long run, is there actually nothing? I mean, are they not getting things done or are they getting it done? But it's just a much more public, vibrant conversation. Because I have to say, when Tony Bennett was in office, I felt like the state school board did anything he wanted. And I never felt like I had any idea what was going on. So at least what we've got now is a situation where you can't help but know what's going on because they're disagreeing and somebody's going to tell you.
Yeah, and they're kicking it out there. We are talking about this legislative session of the Indiana General Assembly on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. My question relates to the Eric Turner situation and the reasons why he refused to step down. And it's my understanding, and I certainly am happy to be corrected on this, that the reason he didn't step down is because he would lose his retirement. And I know from talking to people I know who are active in the Republican Party that several years ago, when Carl Brizzi was facing some pressure to step down, he also chose not to step down for the same reason. And I believe you have to be in for 8 years before you get retirement. I mean, nobody in private in the private sector gets that. So is there going to be any addressing in the legislation, the next session as to the whole pension and retirement plan for elected officials in Indiana, which is what brought about the Eric Turner situation. And I'll be happy to listen to your answers off the air.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Catherine. Mm-hmm. Leslie, I'm going to throw that one to you.
Well, I think that I don't have all of the information right in front of me, but I think it's clear that Eric Turner had been in the legislature long enough to qualify for the retirement plans and any retirement benefits, regardless of whether he had left the legislature at the time all this came up or not.
And part of the issue, I mean, to clarify, if I understand it correctly, was that he, you know, the critics charged that he was lobbying behind closed doors to benefit himself and a couple of his children. And then when the sale of that company went through, I mean, he ended up having a rather significant payday, somewhere in the 7 to 8 figure range, if I recall correctly.
That was reported, and we didn't do our own research on that, so I can only say what's been reported. I can't get in the head of Eric Turner, but yeah. My impression, first of all, he did not appear to have actually broken any laws or rules because mm-hmm. he did follow the guidelines about refraining from any public votes. So the ethics committee, and not everyone agrees, but the ethics committee found that he did not break any rules. Now, they did find that he did not act in what they thought was the best public interest. They also found that they should change their rules in order to prevent a situation like this from happening again. But because he did not break any specific rules, it was hard for the Republicans to sort of force him into a position of having to resign. I don't think there were any retirement benefits for him having to by staying in longer. I'm going to guess it was a pride situation for Representative Turner, knowing him over the years, but not having spoken to him at length about this situation. I'm guessing that's why he waited.
Well, and that was people don't grasp how significant a fall that was, too, because there are people he may have been behind Brian Bosma only, the second most powerful member of the House of Representatives. And by the end of it, he wasn't any longer.
No, absolutely. You're right that he, I would argue that the Ways and Means chairman is right up there, number two, if not number one. Brian Bosma probably would take issue with that suggestion.
We'll wait for his call.
Yeah, he might,
I have them both on tonight. I'll ask them who's in charge.
Having said that, though, obviously Eric Turner was a very prominent member of the House. He was a veteran. He'd been there a long time. He had a lot of power, and this was a huge thing.
We've gotten a comment via Facebook from a listener named Michael, and if you do want to reach out to us via Facebook, you can do so at No Limits, WFYI. Says, typical of most Republican privatizing schemes, the efforts for school privatization only benefit those who are profiting from it, while the teachers get lower salaries and benefits and kids get no better education. It's more of the same crony capitalism disguised as choice. Scott, I'm going to throw that one to you, and I'm going to, Michael, if I might, I'm going to take the liberty of kind of adding a question here. I mean, the level of distrust on both sides of this debate is so high. Is there anything in the governor's budget proposal that's going to seem to cut through that those huge layers of mistrust?
That's a really good question and a tough question. I think one of the problems with this debate is there's a tendency to see the school choice supporting community as sort of one one monolithic viewpoint. And there's really a much broader variety of viewpoints. We talked before about how some advocates for charter schools see them as a pure market solution, and some of them see them as a sort of hybrid, you know, regulation, free market kind of solution. I think that there's a lot of those kinds of fine-grained divides within the school choice community. As an example, there are some who think that some very strong charter school advocates who think that charter schools should be closed very quickly if they don't succeed. And there are others who think they should be given a lot of time, and even those who think they should probably never be shut down, that the market should decide if they should close. So I think it's a little dangerous to presume everyone on that side of the fence is simply pursuing a corporate agenda or pursuing some sort of something that's not necessarily based on the interest of children.
And I actually, Michael, I appreciate you sending the message via Facebook, because it did that whole issue of trust, I think, is one that I'd like to talk about in a different context, because this session, one of the shadows that's kind of looming over the proceedings is the ongoing discussion of Mike Pence's political future, whether he's going to run for president or not. Almost everything the man does now is viewed through that prism, that lens. What kind of effect is that going to have on this legislative session? Jacob, I'm going to start with you on that one.
Well, I think you're right in the fact that everything he does now is viewed like that, and it's really hard to get rid of that. And he's been getting a lot of national media attention, some even dubbing him the next GOP primary winner. And it seems like everything he's done really has been playing to that fact. Obviously, we don't know if he's going to run or not, but at the same time, the way that his office is handling the national media sort of suggests that it's a possibility and it's weighing on his mind. And I'm not sure really if anyone is going to buy thinking that it's not going to have any effect on the session.
Yeah, the legislators, you know, the legislature wants to be thought of as an equal branch of government, and they don't want to be thought of as the people who are trying to help Mike Pence, you know, be the next president. That they want to believe that they are on their own doing things. And so I do think it creates a decent amount of tension there. I think they'll be much more skeptical of proposals that Mike Pence offers that they think have a political motivation.
Well, and I'm going to ask, and I'm going to give Scott a crack at that whole how the Mike Pence, but I'm going to stick with Leslie for just a second. I got to wonder, because since you spend probably more time than anybody with the state's lawmakers, how are they responding? I mean, they had 8 years of Mitch Daniels, and you can say many things about Mitch Daniels, but a shy and retiring presence he wasn't when it came to the process. And by the end, a lot of them were expressing some, oh, We've got Daniel's fatigue here. We're glad he's moving on up the road to Purdue. And then they get Mike Pence, and immediately the whole presidential speculation starts over again. Are they frustrated just about the fact that they can't seem to climb out of this shadow?
I think they have climbed out of the shadow, to be honest. I think they were – you're right. They were done being in Mitch Daniels' shadow. You know, and to be fair, Mitch Daniels came along after 16 years of Democratic governors. And the Republicans were so happy to have a Republican finally to work with. And they were so excited about his ability to bring voters along with him into their districts. I don't think Republicans first of all, when Mike Pence was elected,
he didn't get a majority of the vote.
He didn't get a majority of the vote. He has not seemed to necessarily be able to pull along the same voters that Mitch Daniels was able to. Having said that, Republicans have obviously, they have a supermajority now. They gained in their supermajorities, but they are definitely off being independent for Mike Pence. I mean, there is no doubt. Brian Bosman made clear today that he thought the governor's budget was a starting point, but that they were going to be doing their own thing. And so I would not look for them to be, bowing to his wants and desires.
Yeah, the thanks for playing message.
Yeah, and this question of Pence's presidential ambitions is certainly a factor in discussions about his education policy. Just to give two quick examples over the last year, there was a lot of criticism of him for turning down some federal preschool money. The feeling from some of his critics was that he did it because there were deeply conservative opponents who didn't believe that they should accept federal money because there were federal strings attached. And the other one is Common Core. Mike Pence came out against Common Core and helped lead Indiana to dropping out of those nationally shared standards that other states were adopting. And his critics, again, thought that he did that primarily to position himself for a Republican presidential run. So whether you buy that those were the reasons for his decisions or not, it certainly invites that kind of speculation when he's very heavily involved in education policy, and education is an issue for national Republicans.
We are talking about this session of the Indiana General Assembly here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, and I will say the whole Mike Pence presidential drama thing also has given us, a moment of comic relief early in the process. Mike Delf introduced a bill that would have allowed not just the governor to run for both state office and federal office at the same time, but any state lawmaker. And Leslie, I'll let you talk about what happened to that bill.
Well, the president of the Senate and the Speaker of the House both said right away they didn't think that there was any room for that. That's not a good idea. I think it was David Long who said that he thinks you have to choose. You got to decide what office you want to run for. And I think the public is going to back them up on that.
Well, and it was a fairly emphatic. I mean, he not only said that, but he assigned it to the Rules Committee, which is pretty much the graveyard for bills, right?
Yeah, that bill's not seen in the light of day.
and some of that, there's some history, obviously. Was this more about Brian Bosman and David Long wanting to send a message to Mike Pence or them wanting to send a message to Mike Delf?
I think it's both. I mean, it was just last year that Mike Delf was in the doghouse, sitting with the Democrats, didn't have a press secretary assigned to him. So obviously they're not very happy. Having said that, though, if they really wanted in some way to help Mike Pence, they probably would have not shot it down so quickly. So having said that, Mike Pence said he didn't ask for this bill. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah, he said it wasn't on his agenda and he wasn't going to comment on it. But is Delf out of the doghouse yet, or is there? Do we know?
I'm not sure this helped him. My first thought when I saw Long's comments was, could they surround him with Democrats by moving his chair? Last year, they punished him by moving his seat close to the Democrats.
This year, they're going to put him out.
Maybe they'll put him right in the middle.
Out in the hall.
Yeah, out in the hall.
We are talking about the Indiana General Assembly on No Limits today. My guests are Leslie Weidenbender and Jacob Rund of the StateHouseFile.com and Scott Elliott, who's the Bureau Chief of Chalk Beat, Indiana. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the ongoing session of the Indiana General Assembly here on No Limits. My guests are Leslie Weidenbender, who is the executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, Jacob Rund, who is the assistant editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and Scott Elliott, who is the bureau chief of Chalk Beat, Indiana. Well, before we went to the break, we'd started talking about First Pence's possible presidential aspirations. And Leslie, you'd made the argument that, you know, in some ways the legislature sort of crawled out, or crawled is probably the wrong verb there. They would balk at that one. But has emerged from the shadow of the executive branch to some degree. That said, one of the other issues that I would like for us to talk a little bit about. We've alluded to the fact that, you know, both chambers have Republican supermajorities now. Does that make life easier or harder for Brian Bosma and David Long? I mean, in some ways, there's a school of thought out there that when you have majorities that are that large, the loyal opposition actually comes from within your own caucus, and it gets harder and harder to keep everyone marching together. Leslie, I'll start with you.
I think that obviously it can be much more difficult. If there's a big split or if the split develops in your caucus, it can be really devastating when you have a caucus actually this big. I think at least in the House caucus, though, Brian Bosma has done a remarkable job of leadership in terms of keeping his caucus together. He's also opened up more over the years to more thoughts and ideas. This year, after Eric Turner left, they put Judd McMillan in as the caucus chairman or floor leader, mm-hmm. I think. And he represents a younger group from the legislature. I think that really helps. I actually think David Long has a few more challenges in his caucus. There is a bigger split, I think, between conservatives, social conservatives, and fiscal conservatives in his caucus. But so far, you know, we predicted early on in his leadership time that would be difficult. And so far, he's managed to keep that caucus together pretty well. So I've got to say, I don't see these two supermajorities breaking down anytime soon into different groups that, you know, that render them less powerful.
How about, though, I mean, we started this show by talking about that the whole discussion debate over changing school funding. And, you know, it strikes me as a less well-informed observer than the three of you that one of the things that's going to be so tricky about that is it doesn't necessarily, that debate doesn't break along partisan lines. It doesn't even necessarily break along regional lines, which is the other common kind of fault line in Indiana politics, that it could be really kind of a crazy quilt of pockets of opposition and partnership popping up. What is that likely to do, Scott?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, what happens when they tinker with the funding formula is every legislature gets a call from a dozen superintendents the next day and says, here's what happened to my numbers and wants to know why, you know? So that's an interesting process we're going to navigate. And I also wonder, with the legislature being so Republican, I mean, like, will this is this an avenue for the Democrats to get into the debate? Like, can they find friends in the school funding debate they might be able to ally with? Because right now the Democrats are really sort of on the outside. I mean, their their voice is not very loud in the room. You know, it's the governor and it's Tim Brown and it's the Senate Finance Committee. I mean, those are the people who are doing all the talking and who control the decision making. So I'm, as someone who's relatively new to covering the legislature, this is my fourth year. I thought that already. Like, this might be a chance to see the Democrats maybe get an avenue into being a real player in some of these education debates where they've been on the sidelines a lot.
Jacob, you're in the halls there. I mean, what are you hearing in terms of this sort of stuff? Is there you know, is there a party line in both parties on these issues, or are you hearing, what are you hearing, basically?
Well, I think Scott was right in that everyone's going to have their own opinion. Someone said, I can't remember who today, in the State Budget Committee meeting, that there's 150 legislators and 151 opinions. So I think that it's also important to know that last year the biggest item that was Republicans sort of reached over the aisle and helped out with Democrats is the same-sex marriage amendment. And I think this is what's might turn into that during this session. I think this might be the big item that, like Scott said, that Democrats can team up with Republicans on this and find some friends and maybe make some noise.
I do think that Brian Bosma and David Long realize this is an issue. And so what you keep hearing Brian Bosma say in particular is the key is raising the foundation amount. So the way that the school funding formula works is that there is a basic amount of funding that goes to every student in Indiana. And then different amounts of money get added on to that depending on whether a student qualifies for free or reduced lunch or if they're in special education or if they're in gifted, talented or some, you know, have English as a second language. And so the amount of money for schools gets built that way. By raising the basic foundation amount for each student, you can actually raise the amount that that the lower funded schools get without cutting, at least not very much, the amount that the more urban or the poverty in the areas where there's more poverty without hurting them too much. So really the key is to increase funding more significantly overall, and then there doesn't have to be quite the fight among all the representatives of different districts. Now, when you start doing things like the governor has proposed, and which is earmarking a significant chunk of money for things like charter schools, then you take away the ability to even out the funding formula in ways that hurt fewer schools. So I would envision that the budget that you see come out at least of the House will be one that focuses more on overall funding and less on specialty programs.
On figuring out which side of the education debate they, you know, they want to promote. You know, a lot of the focus and one of the things that both lawmakers and to some degree the governor, both of the past two governors, have talked a lot about as an achievement is the accumulation of the $2 billion surplus. Is that sacrosanct? Is that something that they're not going to touch as part of all of this? Leslie, I'll start with you and then let everybody have a crack at
The governor's office passed out a surplus statement today. It showed that over the next few years, we call it the surplus. What we're really talking about is the state's savings, what the state has sort of in the bank. And that amount would drop just below $2 billion, but I mean just barely below $2 billion, and would stay there throughout the next biennium. What's interesting, though, is by staying at the same amount of money, actually the percentage of that. So the importance of the surplus is how much money you have in the bank versus how much you need to spend or how much you're bringing in every year. And, you know, went back in the late 90s, early 2000s, when the state had, like, I don't know, almost $2 billion in the bank, that was a much larger percentage mm-hmm. of the budget than it is today. And by keeping it right at $2 billion over the next 3 years, that percentage is actually going down a little bit. So, you know, if you want to look at it that way, the surplus actually is going down just a tad.
It's dropping.
But, you know, the big number, the governor likes to talk about $2 billion. Everyone likes to talk about $2 billion. I can't imagine it going much below that.
Because they've locked that into the, sort of the public debate and the dialogue. We are talking about this session of the Indiana General Assembly on No Limits today. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, what are some of the oddball issues or proposals that might have popped up, the stuff that is likely to be more fun? I mean, my guess is by the time the hammer and tongs come out on the school funding formula, it's not going to be a whole lot of fun. But what's some of the stuff that might be enjoyable? Jacob?
I think one of the big ones is definitely Sunday sales, talking about the Sunday sale of alcohol. And this is going to be a pretty big debate in both chambers. And It'll be interesting to see who takes what side. This is one of those issues that isn't necessarily a Republican or Democrat. It's kind of everyone has their own opinion. And I'm excited to see how this debate plays out.
You can tell Jake. You can tell Jacob is the youngest guy in the room because he's all excited about the possibility of being able to buy beer on Sunday.
Absolutely. I'm all for that too. I came from a state that had it, and it's every Sunday. I shop on Sundays, so I go in the grocery store and I forget every time they take a bottle out of my hand.
What are the arguments on both sides with that, Jacob?
Well, I think one of the arguments has to do with religion.
Uh-huh.
And it's observing the Sabbath, observing Sunday, and mm-hmm. making sure that it stays a holy day or something like that along those lines, definitely religious. And then on the other side, it's a boost to the economy. A lot of people say, I mean, why not allow it if it's going to give liquor store owners and grocery store owners more money?
Well, Leslie.
The complicating thing about all of these alcohol laws is they've been around for so many years, and a whole system has grown up around the way our weird alcohol laws are. And so, you know, in addition to Sunday sales, you've got that grocery stores can't sell cold beer, and you've got all these crazy things. Well, some of these businesses, liquor stores, for instance, can't be open at all on Sunday because they can't sell alcohol and they can't sell very many other things as a result of having permission to sell cold beer. And so when you start fooling around with one part of the system, but you don't fool around with other parts of the system, then you start affecting people's livelihoods. And that is part of the question here. Also, this debate is driven more by big box retailers like Kroger or Walmart than it is by liquor store owners who tend to be, not all, but tend to be more likely to be locally owned. And so, you know, you have big, powerful organizations like Kroger versus, every legislator has a handful of liquor store owners in their district who may not want to do this. And so they're very powerful lobbying groups on both sides.
What are the chances that, it sounds like on one end of the spectrum, you've got, we're just going to stay with the set of laws that we've got, and you're going to have to live with the fact that you can't buy beer on Sundays. And the other extreme would sort of be, okay, we're not going to worry about who can sell what, where. That, you know, grocery stores are going to be allowed to sell cold beer. Everybody's going to be able to sell on Sunday.
We're not going to go that far.
Okay.
We're not going to get anywhere close to that kind of thing where the regulation opens wide open. Liquor laws are way too complicated to do that. But I do think Sunday alcohol sales has its best shot that it's had in the almost 20 years that I've been here.
And do you think it's going to pass? Is there?
I don't, but I do think that it will.
It's the best shot ever. It'll never pass.
The best shot ever. I don't think it's going to pass this year, but I do think it's more likely to get somewhere this year. And I think every year after, it just I think it will pass in the next few years. I'm not sure it'll be this year.
Okay, and what are the in looking at what's been put out there so far? Are there any just sort of flat goofy proposals other than the whole, running for president and running for governor at the same time kind of thing?
Yeah, I have one. I just looked at this yesterday, and it's authored by Senator Lonnie Randolph. And what it does is it increases the penalty for an assault against a referee or an official. I think the minimum would be 1 year in prison, and the maximum would be 6 years in prison. And there's a bunch of different facets of that. And it also provides an increased penalty for throwing bodily fluids onto an official that are infested with HIV or tuberculosis.
It's pretty specific.
here's what I want to know somebody went to a Butler's game this week. What are the penalties for bad officiating? How long will those jail terms be? That's just a joke in case you're an official.
Well, and I guess I got to ask the backstory on this one. What problem is this?
You have to assume that something happened.
Something happened somewhere. And
fortunately, Jacob assigned a statehouse file reporter to go find that out. So
we should have an answer as to what prompted this and why. You know, HIV and tuberculosis rather than the whole gamut of other infectious diseases.
Well, we haven't talked about the pot bill. We got to talk about
All right.
We got to talk about marijuana.
You go marijuana.
Well, closely. Senator Karen Talion has been trying for years to get pot decriminalized. And what that would have meant is that using marijuana would have become a like a ticket more rather than a criminal offense. She has gotten nowhere on that in Indiana. And so just a lot of stories because we all love covering it, but no, nowhere in the legislature. This year, she's proposing to legalize marijuana for medical use. It doesn't sound like she's probably going to get a hearing. It doesn't sound like that's going to go anywhere. But the more she talks about it, and obviously the more other states go down this road, I think the more likely Indiana is going to have to get to that discussion at some point.
There's a couple goofy education bills.
Okay.
Goofy is maybe the wrong word. But
offbeat.
Offbeat. Okay. One is for the fourth consecutive year, we will discuss cursive writing and whether that should be required. It no longer is by the state, the Department of Education. Senator Lysing has brought this bill forward 3 years in a row. It always passes the Senate by a large margin, and it is never taken up in the House because the House Education Committee Chairman
Bob Benning.
Because
they couldn't read it when it came over.
Yeah, it just comes over. But Bob Benning, who's chair of the House Education Committee, does not believe that the legislature should legislate this kind of curriculum. However, last year, Senator Lysing put on a very aggressive campaign, sent letters to all of her colleagues over in the House, and really lobbied to try to get them to persuade him to let it go forward. So there is that question as to how big the lobbying effort will be. And then there was some story in the Indianapolis Star this week about Senator Cruz wanting a bill that would require children to pass a civics test, the same test that you have to pass to become a citizen of the United States if you're foreign, or a similar test in order to graduate high school. The Star, I noticed, has a quiz you can take to see how well you do on it. I got one wrong out of like 20, so I guess I get to stay.
Now I'm afraid to take the test because I'm afraid I'll do worse.
There was one really hard question, and I can't remember what it was, but most of them are I felt comfortable that pretty much any kid who knew anything in our state could pass in order to graduate.
So if people want to talk actually with legislators and other players about these events, the event you're having tonight at the Central Library.
Yes, not about the goofy bills.
No, it's about education and public policy in general.
Indeed, it's about school funding. It's at 5:30 tonight at the Central Library, co-sponsored with WFY. And the Central Library has we have two key legislators and two superintendents, including IPS's Lewis Farabee, and we're going to talk about how they might change a school funding formula and what it will mean for all the different kinds of districts in the state.
And I assume it's open to the public?
It is definitely open to the public.
And there's no charge to attend or anything?
No charge at all. The library is a great partner for us. They love to host these kind of events. And same, FYI, also in the public interest, likes to have these kinds of community conversations. So if you would like to talk about school funding, which you all listening to this
know,
you really want to. Yeah. You want to hear about it. You want to talk about it. You can come to the Central Library. And it really will be a good debate. I think it will be very interesting.
Well, I'd like to thank all of you. I'd like to thank my guest, Leslie Weidenbender, Jacob Rund of the StateHouseFile.com, and Scott Elliott, who is the Bureau Chief of Chalkbeat Indiana. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.